This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear about a new study on racial and income equality in Bloomington Normal. It finds disparities in policing, environmental pollution, discrimination, and affordable housing.
While some housing in Bloomington Normal might be affordable, the quality is really low.
GLT's Judy Valente talks with ISU student researchers about the data, and you'll hear from Mike Matika with Not In Our Town, the group which commissioned the study. What happens now that President Trump has fired FBI Director James Comey? Find out what ISU political scientist Megan Leonard thinks. And find out what you need to do to keep a star of your garden shining bright. During an edition of Grow, Laura Kennedy and Patrick Murphy talk hydrangeas. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's May 10th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The FBI director is out, fired unceremoniously by President Trump. As soon as news of the termination broke, some political observers began to sound off that something didn't add up, saying the timing is suspicious and the reasoning convenient. Megan Leonard is a political observer and an Illinois State University associate professor in politics in the Politics and Government Department. Megan, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Sure.
What constitutes a constitutional crisis, and are we headed to one, or am I jumping the gun here?
It's not quite clear, but we know a couple of things. One is there were reasons for James Comey to be fired. The Democrats had been on these reasons since he released that memo in late October. Two, the president has the power to fire the FBI director. That's just fine. And three, this is completely unprecedented, right? The last FBI director to be fired was under the Clinton administration because he was using government money for his own purposes. Never have we had a president fire, especially an FBI director, who was currently investigating the president and the administration. Is that a constitutional crisis? We can't say yes yet, but we could be very much headed that way.
Why now, do you suppose? Why fire James Comey now?
Well, that's, I think, right, the biggest question. The Republicans say, hey, the Democrats have been calling for this. Look at how bad he's handled his job. There are reasons. Last week when he testified, he lied about the investigation, though that didn't come up in the reasoning handed out by the deputy attorney general. So that's the good reason, right? The reason the Trump administration is selling. It's also possible that he is fired because he was about to find something. He was about to release something. And we've just learned this morning that just last week he had asked for more resources to continue the investigation into the ties between the Trump administration and Russia.
How would you characterize the political savviness of the Trump-Pence administration? For instance, the letter Trump sent Comey, which proclaims the letter firing James Comey that proclaims Trump's innocence, or underestimating the political fallout of this firing, or the fact that this might make Trump look guilty of something.
There is no political savviness, right? There are so many optics mistakes that have been made by this administration and handling this investigation, right? The Comey firing is actually the third firing of somebody who was conducting an investigation of
Sally Yates,
the Trump administration.
The New York City AG.
Exactly.
A prosecutor.
Exactly. There may have been good reasons to fire all three, but at some point, right, that count adds up and people start to think that anybody getting close to finding out something negative about this administration, their response is to fire them. And that looks really, really bad.
Does it matter? Do the optics matter at this point? If Trump keeps his base, does it matter?
Well, he seems to think they don't, and he and his administration is out there defending it. he has his base, but remember his approval ratings are really low. So his base can only do so much. What he needs are especially Republican senators to fall in line with the administration. And we're starting to see that shake. And I think as we see his approval rating continue to decrease and members of the Senate see more and more outspokenness of their constituents, he's going to start losing some of them. He hasn't lost Mitch McConnell yet, which is most important, but we're seeing little breaks along the way.
Lindsey Graham for one, John right. McCain for another.
Right, right.
What do you make, we're talking about optics, what do you make of the timing or the optics of the Russian foreign minister visiting the Oval Office today?
Once again, right, you just wonder how bad the decision-making is in the administration in terms of political optics. It is important for our government to meet with representatives of other governments. There's nothing wrong with the meeting itself. And then on top of it, right, people are calling this move Nixonian for whatever that's worth. Trump also met with Henry Kissinger today. How many optics mistakes do they plan to make around this announcement?
So you can't really cancel the visit from the Russians to the Oval Office, but you could certainly reschedule the firing.
Yes.
What do you think we can learn about Trump's motivation from who he may choose as the next FBI director?
I think we can learn a lot, right? The names that were just talked about not too long ago are all sort of career FBI members. Putting somebody in who's long been in the FBI or is a federal judge or a federal prosecutor, not in the Trump team or the Trump sort of group, might be a good idea. If we see somebody like Rudy Giuliani or Chris Christie, and these aren't necessarily names that are being bandied about, then that's a strong signal that Trump is looking for somebody to protect him.
Politico listed Rudy Giuliani and Chris Christie as options in a list of 10, though.
Right.
So, I mean, they are bandied about, maybe not being talked about. They are. What are your thoughts on the role of the Department of Justice and the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, in this firing? Sessions recused himself from the investigation into Russian meddling, but then turned around and participated in the firing of the head of the organization that was doing the investigation.
Again, and I think Jeff Sessions should not have played any role. This could have been something that went straight from the Deputy Attorney General to the President. And Jeff Sessions today has been announced that he's playing a significant role in choosing the next FBI director. Under normal circumstances, that would be the job of an attorney general. These are not normal circumstances. This person will be continuing an investigation Sessions has recused himself from. So again, it just all looks bad, and it all points to really the worst interpretation of what could have happened.
Do you believe in coincidence? I mean, at some point, don't you have to start saying there's enough smoke here that there may be fire?
That's exactly right, right.
What happens to the FBI investigation, do you think? Surely some of the FBI agents are squirreling away evidence already gathered for fear that the investigation may be derailed or sidetracked or halted.
Yes, right. And I think the FBI investigation goes on. And then there's also the possibility that this sort of lit a fire under career FBI officials who may have been loyal to Comey, saw this firing not only as politically bad, but the way he found out on TV while speaking to FBI agents, he thought it was a joke. I think we might see some FBI agents sort of take this as a personal challenge and say, we are going to find... They're not going to use it to find something, but they're going to make sure the investigation continues.
And if it is slowed down or derailed, we might see leaks.
Yes.
Of what's already been discovered.
Yes.
You mentioned Watergate. During the Nixonian factor in this, during Watergate, there was a democratically controlled Congress investigating the White House. What do you think should happen and what do you think will happen regarding a congressional investigation?
So both houses of Congress are sort of investigating right now, the Senate with a little more rigor than the House.
And both controlled by the GOP.
Yeah. And of course, the House had the problems with Devin Nunes and all of that. I think that right now, Republicans are still in sort of a wait and see. They don't know yet if it's time to break with Trump. When Nixon suggested to the Attorney General fire Archibald Cox, that was a signal to Republicans that it was time to break with their party in the 1960s. We're not at that point. That investigation was much further along. But it's not impossible that we get to that point, and we could get to that point soon, and Republicans will realize that it's time to jump off the sort of Trump train and move forward.
Other similarities or dissimilarities with Watergate and the so-called Saturday Night Massacre?
In that case, right, like I said, the investigation was much further along. That was a special prosecutor, and in the administrators, the administration officials said no to a president. They refused to go through with it, and so many got fired. I think it's still wait and see if we can call it the Tuesday Night Massacre.
I'm fine with calling that at this point. I think you've maybe coined something here. Senator John McCain has called for a, quote, special congressional committee to investigate Russia's interference into the 2016 election and stated that it's more important now than ever with the firing of James Comey. What can this committee accomplish without the support of the FBI? I assume they're lending their investigative resources to the Senate, or is that the way it works?
Yeah, the Senate will have subpoena power, and they would be able to call in members of the FBI, and the FBI is doing their own investigation because we have criminal investigations and counterintelligence investigations and all sorts of moving parts. So the Senate could create their own committee, and then there's also talk of hiring a special prosecutor, which is now called special counsel. The problem with that is that would have to come from either the attorney general or now, because the attorney general is recused, probably the deputy attorney general. And I don't think anybody sees that happening.
Why would that happen? Could Comey work for or join the Senate investigation?
He could certainly testify.
That's different. I'm talking about something other than testifying. Could he actually be part of that investigation, work toward helping to uncover evidence or providing what's already been discovered?
I don't see a legal reason why not, but again, we sort of be getting into the optics of do we want to hire the political appointee who was fired? But certainly the FBI, I think, is going to continue to help the Senate investigation.
Is there permanent damage occurring to the presidency or our democracy at this point, do you think?
I think if we continue to do nothing and this president continues to sort of run roughshod over norms, while he's technically within the lines of the law in many ways, this could have really negative long-term effects about the legitimacy of our institutions.
Megan Leonard, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it. Megan Leonard is an associate professor with ISU's Politics and Government Department. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
For GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A new report on inequality in Bloomington Normal shows that poor and minority residents live in neighborhoods that have more noise and air pollution, less quality housing, fewer places to buy fresh, healthy food, and less transportation opportunities. The report also found police traffic stops in Normal outpace the number of stops in larger central Illinois cities, but that Bloomington police are viewed as being more aggressive in dealing with minorities. The Stevenson Center for Community and Economic Development compiled the report for the grassroots organization Not in Our Town. It presents a portrait of a community where disparities between the races and the rich and the poor have lingered for decades. GLT's Judy Valente spoke with three of the researchers from Illinois State University who worked on the report.
This is Renee Palachek. Overall, I found that though there are a lot of areas where Bloomington Normal needs to improve, everybody in the community is really hopeful for the future, and they see the community improving quickly with all the action that they're willing to take.
Danielle Stevens, you also worked on the report. What was surprising to you?
The most surprising thing was to find that Black Americans are incarcerated at an extremely disproportionate rate in terms of the percentage of the population that they actually comprise in the community.
What do you think that's due to?
It manifests itself in the length of time that people spend in jail, who gets actually searched when stopped by policemen.
That has been a long-term issue in this county. How does one go about affecting change?
The scope of this project was really not to discover how to solve these problems. It was more to paint a picture of what life is like in Bloomington Normal in our community. But I can tell you that there are some theories that we relied upon to explain why these things happen, and those might be helpful moving forward. One of those is social dominance theory, which is the idea that when humans organize themselves, we inherently build hierarchies. And there is a very small group of people that ends up with a lot of power, and you end up with this kind of hegemonic power structure.
Certainly, if you look at McLean County, Bloomington Normal, the power structure is pretty white, pretty well-to-do.
Correct. And those power structures are really perpetuated by what are called legitimizing myths. And they're basically these stereotypes that we believe to be true, regardless of whether they are or not. And they really help perpetuate these power structures. And these power structures are incredibly pervasive and difficult to overthrow. Another theory that we relied upon to understand the data that we were analyzing was the idea of colorism, which is that the darker your skin, the more likely you are to be discriminated against. So with the data that we analyzed, that theory was useful for understanding why Latinos might seem to face less discrimination than Black Americans.
Teddy Dondenville, you also worked on this study. What jumped out at you?
I'd have to say one of the findings that surprised me the most is how Bloomington Normal is organized geographically. We did some work looking at segregation and where these sorts of diverse populations pop up in the community. And there tends to be specific locations within Bloomington Normal, for instance, on the west side of Bloomington and even on the closer to the east side of towards Veterans Parkway. When you account for where we find certain types of environmental hazards, such as the railroad tracks and other sorts of industrial sites and sources of pollution, those diverse pockets of people tend to be living more closely to these sources of pollution.
So that's an interesting finding, that neighborhoods that are more diverse and may have a larger component of, say, Black or brown people are going to be closer to spots that are polluted.
Yes, that's correct. And there's a sort of historical component to that with regards to how we sell property and property values and what sort of racial components are built into that system.
Well, we should say, when you say polluted, what do we mean here? Do we mean living near the landfill, living near the wastewater treatment plant?
Yeah, those are two very good examples. The way that we operationalized sources of pollution in this project was odor, air pollution, and then also noise pollution. So as you said, the water treatment plant is a good example, but also we have the railroad tracks down there. The cargo plant is also a good example of one of these sources of pollution. And then also even in Normal, we have the Bridgestone plant, which tends to be one of those sources of air pollution.
Let's go back to Renee Palachek. Renee, what are some of the areas that we need to work on for greater equality or greater inclusiveness?
In our focus groups, we really found that affordable housing is hard to come by in Bloomington Normal. And we found that overlapping in some interviews as well. So when I talk about affordable housing, I'm discussing affordable quality housing. While some housing in Bloomington Normal might be affordable, the quality is really low, or the landlords exploit their residents or their tenants. And another topic that came up in both focus groups and interviews was the policing in Bloomington Normal. We found in both focus groups and interviews that community members in Normal are to be stopped by police more often, but the aggression from police officers is higher in Bloomington. This goes for both white, Black, and Latino Americans.
So people are stopped by police more often in Normal
Correct.
Than Bloomington.
Correct.
And then a certain amount of aggressiveness sets in with what group?
Mm-hmm. Specifically Black Americans. And this might be due to the different policing styles between the police departments of Normal versus the police department of Bloomington. But we found that community members and community leaders in our focus groups were especially concerned about the aggressiveness from Bloomington Police Department and simply their policing style. And this especially affects our Black American community, since, as Teddy alluded to, these more diverse or minority populations are situated in West Bloomington.
Okay, but it was the normal department, though, that stopped people more often. What mm-hmm. about the way minorities were treated in normal?
Honestly, none of the participants in either focus groups or interviews discussed the aggressiveness or treatment from normal PD. However, I think Danny can clarify on those accounts.
Go ahead, Danielle.
So regarding there being more stops than normal, that is accurate. Last year, normal police stopped people around 19,000 times, which is significantly higher than even Springfield, and was also compared to Decatur, Peoria, Urbana, Champaign, and Rockford. There is a wider disparity in Bloomington regarding who gets searched based on race when they are stopped. And that disparity it still exists in normal, but it's not as significant. And I think that we can potentially attribute that to the demographics of the communities as well, especially when we consider the west side of Bloomington is more predominantly minority population.
What else, Teddy?
Well, we did some geographic mapping on food accessibility in Bloomington Normal. And we found that there are some areas in Bloomington Normal that are less able to receive good food. And by good food, I mean whole foods, fruits and vegetables. And not
fresh foods.
Fresh foods, exactly.
Fresh meats, yeah.
There are a couple food deserts in Bloomington and also in Normal. But the difference, I think, between these food deserts, say, in Bloomington and Normal is income. So for an area to be a food desert, you need to have low income and low access, meaning transportation. And so we find in Bloomington areas with both low access and low accessibility. And the difference between that and Normal is that in Normal we have low access and distance between good foods, but higher incomes. So these people that are living in Normal in these designated food deserts, one can probably afford some sort of transportation to get there.
And sure, two, they have cars.
Exactly, they have private transportation.
What specific neighborhoods in Bloomington would you say are food deserts? Because it seems to be more of a problem for poor people in Bloomington than people in Normal with higher incomes.
It's predominantly South and Southwest Bloomington that has issues with food accessibility. There are some grocery stores that run along Main Street, and then also on Market Street, and even we have that Walmart on the far west of town. But when it comes down to mileage and transportation times, there is a discrepancy there between how quickly and easily people in Southwest and West Bloomington can get groceries.
Danielle, let's go back to the jail population and issues there, what the situation is and what needs to be done.
We found that although whites comprise over 50% of the jail population, Black Americans comprise 36%, which is extremely disproportionate considering they're only about 8% of the population. Black Americans are spending almost twice as long in jail than whites are, 14 days compared to 8. It is important to note that we're looking at overall convictions, so that disparity might be attributed to the charge that they're being booked on, but that those results might differ when controlling for the offense. But what we found so far is that Black Americans are spending almost twice as long in jail than whites, and Latinos also spend more time in jail than whites.
Renee, you wanted to say something. Renee Palachek.
Yes. Within our focus groups and our interviews, we made a point to ask questions regarding the future of Bloomington Normal and how Bloomington Normal can improve. So regarding the jail population or regarding policing in general, a lot of our participants noted that we need to come up with new innovative ways to handle these situations. So one specific example could be a community action group that analyzes policing or incidences with police, holding the police accountable and holding the community accountable. So the issue that we found with this was that the police are investigating themselves, and that doesn't really create a lot of incentive to carry out a well-organized analysis. So a community group that helps out with these investigations could be useful.
Something maybe like a police citizen review board.
Absolutely.
I understand that you did not just focus on race or ethnic groups, but also looked at the LGBTQ community and then also the disabled. Can you talk a little bit about LGBTQ issues? Danielle.
We discovered that the situation for this group has definitely improved over time, especially since Not in Our Town has been in our community. But there is still a lot of work that needs to be done, especially for transgender people specifically. Our focus groups indicated that transgender people specifically experience more police brutality. There also are not a lot of services available in the community regarding healthcare. So if someone is wanting to transition, they often have to go to a larger area like Chicago to get the services that they need. And having such a large city nearby means that there's not really an impetus for our community to bring those services here. But a lot of those people maybe are not able to get to Chicago to get the help that they need.
Disabled people. Renee?
Very often, the disabled community is left out of the conversation when we talk about discrimination, intolerance, and bigotry. And we found that a large problem for this community is workplace discrimination. And the conversation regarding disability needs to change. So what I mean by that is understanding that disabled communities or community members are not incapable of working, of understanding, of learning, or of doing anything. They may need provisions for this, and these provisions should be provided. They are dedicated and intelligent members of the community, and we found that very often people in management don't want to work with the disabled community to include them in their organizations.
I would have to say one of the other topics that came up that hopefully can be improved in the future is public transportation. Now, it's important to understand that Bloomington Normal has a relatively widespread public transportation. If you look at it on a map, you can get to where you need to go. But it's really important to know that travel time is not very good in Bloomington Normal. Transferring buses can take up to 45 minutes. Getting east to west or north to south can take a long time, not to mention that it's expensive. So a lot of our community members who rely on our public transportation system both had good things to say, but also would like to see some more availability with regards to pickups and drop-offs, and then also maybe a little bit more affordability as well.
I want to thank all three of you for the hard work and effort that you put into this very important research for our community. Thank you to Renee Palachek, Danielle Stevens, and Teddy Dandenville.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Judy Valente.
Researchers also find Bloomington Normal is less segregated than several other central Illinois cities. One suggestion focus group members gave the ISU researchers is to have more street festivals that celebrate Twin City diversity. The six-month study was conducted for the anti-racism group Not in Our Town, which asked for a review of a variety of systems, not just police departments, to get a better understanding of who is being mistreated, underserved, or left behind. WGLT's Colleen Reynolds talks with Mike Matika from Not in Our Town following last night's public presentation of the work. The more than two dozen ISU graduate and undergraduate students who are part of the Illinois State University Stevenson Center for Community and Economic Development.
So Mike Matika, we just listened to hour-long presentation from the students who have been working for a semester at the Stevenson Center to investigate a variety of areas: racism, discrimination, equality as it affects different demographics throughout the community. What would you say overall is your response, because this is a report that you actually were commissioning from the Stevenson Center?
Number one, the students were very passionate. You know, they really did an excellent job. They really put their hearts into it, and that's very, very appreciated. You could tell they really took this project very seriously. I think what's important in this is so often when people think of discrimination, they take it individually, like I'm not racist, I'm not sexist, and don't always look at the systematic underlying, whether they're economic, whether they're racial disparities, whether they're gender disparities, whether they're disparities against LGBTQ folks, whether it's by economic class. And we don't realize the impact of those things. So an individual may feel they're absolved because they try not to harbor feelings against others, but we have to look at systems. And I think what was really helpful here today was to look at statistics on criminal justice, on police stops, on where grocery stores are located, where health facilities are, where pollution is in the community, and see that that's often has a strong correlation to class and to race. And so I think the most helpful thing here is how do we begin to look at these as a system? Because there may be wonderful people in town who don't feel they discriminate, but when we look at the patterns, then we say, okay, what do we need to adjust in our healthcare system? What do we need to adjust in police practices? What do we need to adjust in terms of access to employment and to decent food? Those are questions that I think are the things we really need to pick apart, and I think this is an excellent first step to starting to look at those systems.
There's been an awful lot of attention in the past to minority police relations, and that is only a piece of this report. Do you see that as still a very pressing issue that needs to be addressed first, or how do you prioritize areas that you're going to tackle?
Well, number one, you know, Not in Our Town is an all-volunteer group, so we tackle what we can tackle when we can do it. It's interesting when the students referred to the Not in Our Town scrapbook. We went back and collected articles from the last over 20 years of not just Not in Our Town, but activities in the community. Police relations shows up again and again and again, whether it's 1999 or 2005. That's a recurring topic. And so that tells us it's not something you're going to solve overnight. Our departments locally, I think, have shown goodwill in terms of wanting to work on these issues, but they're extremely hard issues too. Nobody wants to feel like they're being discriminatory, but what are maybe some of the underlying, maybe cultural things that are happening that maybe we can all learn from each other? Maybe the police department needs to learn more from people in various communities, and maybe those communities need to learn more from the police too, but how do we go a little bit deeper than just saying, well, there's a bad apple here or a bad apple there? How do we look at the culture that's out there, and not just police culture, but community culture too, in terms of how do we bridge those gaps and how do we build some human understanding within that process?
Do you think that it's time to consider a citizen oversight panel, at least in Bloomington, where the students found there was a greater disparity?
You know, a citizens review board is one instrument, and I think not only Black Lives Matter, but Not in Our Town, ACLU, other groups are looking at this and saying, is there something there that could be useful, not just to the community, but also to the police force and police department? And I think one of the challenges is you hear complaint. How do you verify complaint? How do you make sure people feel they can complain and not feel like there's going to be retribution against them? How do you make people feel like their complaints are being taken seriously and they don't bother to say anything because they don't feel like they're being listened to? It's not an easy one to tackle, and Citizens Review Board, I think, is something that definitely we all have to be open to. And there may be a methodology there that could help not only the community, but may also strengthen the police department, because then they're actually getting maybe more direct access to what are some of the issues that people are feeling in the neighborhoods.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. We're talking with Mike Matika from Not in Our Town about results of a study that took a look at systems within Bloomington Normal and how responsive they are to community needs as they relate to different demographics. So healthcare was another area. It wasn't highlighted too predominantly in this presentation, but I know that, for example, there is fundraising underway for a Pride Health Center that would address health issues that are specific to LGBTQ.
Yeah, and again, we can look at health from a variety of angles. You know, are folks like LGBTQ folks getting access to appropriate health care for them? I think with what's going on in Washington, D.C., are we going to see a resurgence of low-income people, non-insured people running into the emergency rooms, which taxes our health care system? And I think one of the things they did well was to kind of link that to also to access to green space and healthy food, too, so that when people want to live a more healthy life, do they have access to the instruments to do that? And that's often a really big issue in low-income areas and underserved areas where transportation and being able to afford and get to good food can be a real issue for folks.
I want to jump on transportation because I think what we heard here was even though we have good bus routes, it still takes a long time for someone to get where they need to go. And with transit funding very uncertain, how do you address that?
Yeah, and Connect Transit, I think, has tried really hard to look at their routes, to look at their systems, to see how people can get from one side of town to another. And, you know, maybe that's one of the challenges of an automotive age, in a sense that a walkable, compact community is what core Bloomington Normal was built around. But how do you run buses to cul-de-sacs? You know, and as our community has spread out, how do you ensure that people can get, let's say, from the west side of Bloomington to Northeast Normal, where a lot of the specialty clinics are? That could be an hour and a half bus ride just to get there very easily. And again, I don't know if we got an answer to that, but I think that's, again, an important issue of access, is how do people get around town and how do they get to services that can be significant for their life?
Another area that was not addressed was access to loans for various parts of the community. Is that something you can see in the future looking at? Because that is sort of a system that hasn't been examined yet.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that could be another study would be who's got access to banking, who's got access to loans, who's got access to mortgages when you look at affordable housing, who can get a bank loan to afford a home. And again, are there some underlying patterns of discrimination there, which is going to take a little bit more digging, but I think there'd be some very interesting community Investment Act data that's out there that maybe a future study could look at, because it would be very curious to see what ethnic groups are able to get loans and in what neighborhoods people are able to get loans.
So you heard the question asked after the presentation, and that is, what is not in our town going to do with these results? I know they recommended focusing on education, advocacy, and there was another area. You know, where do you begin?
I think maybe the good challenge that this brings to Not in Our Town is when the group began, it was often reactive. You know, here's a situation going on in the community, and oftentimes you do have to react to things that are happening. But how do we become more proactive? How do we look at these long-term issues of discrimination and disparity and maybe help the community dialogue about those, look for solutions, be creative to see what we can do to answer some of those questions?
Did it strike you that some of the best practices that were highlighted in various communities included many of the things that are ongoing in Bloomington Normal?
Yeah, and when the students wanted to look at other social movements and other groups, I specifically asked them not to look at major metropolitan areas, but look at smaller cities. And I think Not in Our Town compares fairly well to what other groups, other cities are doing, because we've always been all volunteer. We don't have paid staff. We don't have a big funding base, but we do have some very committed people that really want to look at these issues and want to work around these challenges.
Their conclusion talked about additional social media presence, collaborating with universities and other organizations, and encouraging sponsorship. Again, a lot of that, you are pretty active on social media, and you have collaborated with universities and groups.
Yeah. No, I mean, and again, ISU, Wesley, and Heartland have all been very good on these issues, and we continue to want to work with them. And the Not in Our Schools program that our young people are doing in the junior high and the high schools has been getting great support in both District 87 and Unit 5. And to me, that's one of the proudest things, is that the young people are, they're initiating their own programs and talking to themselves and coming up with solutions. And that's a great sign of hope for our future.
And I would imagine this is going to raise the profile of Not in Our Town, just this study alone, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I'm sure it will raise the profile, and that's a challenge to Not in Our Town to respond, to be more active, and to answer some of these questions. And at the same time, I think one of the long-term great things of Not in Our Town is assuming that community identity means we have to live up to it. And that creates kind of a barometer that we all have to do that little bit extra. So when things happen, like at McGraw Park this past weekend, which was, you know, very shameful and terrible, then you have to ask yourself, who's doing it? What's their motivation? What if they're young people, and can't presume that, but what are they being taught? And what are they being told? and that tells us we've got work to do when things like that happen.
Mike Matika, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Always my pleasure. Thank you.
GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds on Sound Ideas here on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Once upon a time, there were some eager gardeners who wanted to make something grow.
I planted roses.
I'm growing heirloom tomatoes.
Purple coneflower for me.
And they each ran into problems along the way.
Ew, black spots.
Wilt, so much wilt.
Is this supposed to be brown?
But I helped them out with that, and now their gardens really grow. My name is Murph. I can help you too. Send in your gardening questions to WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Skin Dimensions Day Spa. Their licensed estheticians provide personalized plans for your skincare needs, including facials, peels, microdermabrasion, and more. Skin Dimensions Day Spa at Soderstrom Skin Institute is proud to serve McLean County at 2100 Jacobson Drive in Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The old-fashioned appeal of the hydrangea makes them a star in the garden. In this edition of GLT's Grow, Patrick Murphy has all the details you need to put this showstopper to work in your garden and to keep it shining bright.
Love the lovely hydrangea? Well, here's how to enjoy that plant. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice. From our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it is Patrick Murphy. Hello there, Murph.
Laura, hi.
Today on GLT's Grow, Murph has advice on how to cultivate hydrangeas. They are lovely, aren't they?
Is there any doubt that they are one of the most useful and lovely adaptable flowers in the landscape?
And you get great cut flowers from them.
Thank you. I was going to say that they are oftentimes left to waste. You know, after the beauty is gone, there's still an opportunity there. And I know a gal named Marianne in Monticello, Illinois.
Yeah.
That she would let her Annabelle, that's hydrangea arborescens, she would let them dry on the stem with the little stem holder and then paint them silver with silver spray paint as part of her holiday decor. And
cool.
It was always fabulous.
So this is a very versatile plant.
They're great. And they have their own family. Hydrangeas are in the Hydrangeaceae family.
Mm-hmm.
And to talk about them, I kind of grouped them in some predictable groups. And then as far as cultivating them and growing them, it's like choosing the right tool for the job.
Alrighty.
So I can talk to everybody about them that way. I mentioned the Annabelle hydrangea, hydrangea arborescens. They're very, very much known for that big, humongous white drumstick flower, you know, like the size of a child's head, just this great big thing, you know. And they are great for a hedge. They're great for floral stock. They're great for live flower arrangements and other decor items just because of the scope and the size of the flowering on this plant. And another thing is they're native to the U.S., and that's always an important thing to point out, being in the Department of Biology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so even for folks that are up in Minnesota and lower parts of Alberta, Canada, you could have this in your landscape because they're hardy to zones 2 and 3.
That's great. That's wonderful.
That is really fantastic. So now we can talk about hydrangea macrophylla. Endless Summer is a very popular cultivar of that range of hydrangea. The macrophyllas come in a lace cap and a mop head is kind of the categories for the flowers there.
A mop head, I love that.
And they're the ones that are blue or white, depending upon the soil composition.
Okay, so what are we talking about, pH in the soil?
That's right, that's right. And they have kits that are a little more safe for that gardening endeavor.
Kits?
Yeah. Maybe kits not the right word, but this is, they have amendments that are prepackaged for the purpose of trying to manipulate the pH to change hydrangea flower color.
So if you want it to be blue, what do you want? More, higher pH or a lower pH? Or?
I believe it's higher.
Okay.
Higher. And this is also right place, right plant type thing.
Okay, great.
If you have to do that, it's not going to stay that way, and you're probably going to encounter other problems. But they're generally speaking a fairly disease-resistant plant.
That's nice to know.
you can have the blue without having to do all the extra chemistry.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, hydrangeas 101, and I always thought it was hard work to get them blue.
For the macrophyllas, it is.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very popular because they're a little bit on the smaller side. They're a really nice garden shrub or bedding shrub.
Right.
They're much smaller than the hydrangea arborescens. The Annabelle is a large shrub, you know, like chest high. The others are smaller. I would consider them part of the ground layer in a landscape or a garden.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, we talked about the blue, and I don't want to discourage people from doing that. But to me, that's like trimming a shrub to make it work in a location where it is too large for the setting or something along those lines.
Uh-huh.
Because as I was saying, if you like the blue, there's other choices.
All right, then what are those
Panicle choices? Panicle hydrangeas, another group of hydrangeas, Laura, and they have some fabulous ones that I know you're going to love when I tell you their names.
Yes?
Tardiva.
Ooh.
Tardiva. Hey,
are you sure that's not a dinosaur?
It makes me want some chocolate, or is that Godiva?
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, but this is a tree form, sometimes grafted, and kind of an upright, leafy hydrangea that doesn't have the round little tea saucer type flowers, got a long spearhead shaped flower.
Cool.
They are fantastic for giving us flower in the heat of the summer at a time that the landscape is a little bit starved for flowers.
Yes.
And then it carries over into the early fall with some unbelievable pink colors in the foliage.
Oh, gorgeous.
Right.
Pink. I love that.
So, you know, when we talked about doing this topic before, I said, oh, great, I get to talk about PG hydrangeas. I just love them. They are a blue snowball type hydrangea, and they're a woody hydrangea. But the little snowball sized flowers are pale blue. And again, this one can be grown in a tree form without grafting. So it is a woody, rigid hydrangea. They are underutilized. You just don't see them as often as you could see them.
That's a shame.
Yeah. And then there's another native hydrangea to the United States that's the oak leaf hydrangea. That's Hydrangea quercifolia. I always think that the Latin names are interesting,
yeah,
right? Because the genus for oak is Quercus.
Oh.
So the descriptor for this species of hydrangea is quercifolia. So it's got that little quercus part in there indicating the oak nature of the leaf.
So cool.
It's just really cool, yeah. But this is a great hydrangea because it has the late summer large ice cream cone type white flower.
Mm-hmm.
You can get it in shades of pink. This is a hydrangea that'll grow with a lot more shade and in drier soils. And that's really handy here in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And it's really handy in construction site type landscape developments. So if you live in Eagle's Nest, Eagle's Ridge, Eagle's
One of the many
Wings,
eagles
whatever,
around here.
You know, right? You know, y'all know what I'm talking about, the various subdivisions, where they scrape away everything and leave you something that's a little more challenging to garden in.
Clay.
Hydrangea quercifolia, the oak leaf hydrangea, and tardiva are for you.
Mm-hmm.
They're the good, bad soil hydrangeas. Yeah.
Do they have really nice color in the fall with the leaves?
Again, this one is noted for that.
Okay.
So we get the pink from the tardiva. So if you had the tardivas and the oak leaves in layers, you could have pink with burgundy and red.
Oh, that'd be gorgeous.
Yeah, so the oak leaf hydrangea has a noteworthy fall color. And then once they get up to have some size, the naked stems that are left after the leaves fall, they have like a peeling type birchy looking stem and bark. So they even have character in the winter.
Great. Winter character. Love that.
How about it? It's just fantastic.
Yeah. It sounds like a winter all around.
And then the only one thing is sad faces for soggy feet. They don't like soggy feet. You know. So if it's a commercial landscape where there's irrigation, I don't know. That might be a problem.
Okay.
But we have to talk about the climbers.
All right, then.
To talk about the climbers, Laura.
Let's hear it.
Climber, the climbing hydrangea, the Hydrangea anomala petiolaris, right? So vines climb with petioles. Mm-hmm. Here's another cool Latin name function there. This is a great hydrangea. They can break your heart, though, because they won't flower every year. They just won't. They're in biology, in the circles of science, I am in agreement that there is an interruption in the weather cycles to the extent that it's affecting the pollinators, and the hydrangeas are one plant that see that most often.
That's a shame.
Already in 2017, 11 calls from folks with hydrangeas asking why aren't they getting flowers.
because they need the pollinators.
They need the pollinators, and the strange weather is interrupting that. Last one is the Chinese climbing hydrangea. That's Schizophragma. It's still in the hydrangea family. That's the Chinese climbing hydrangea, beautiful climbing hydrangea with smooth leaves.
All right, that sounds gorgeous. Thanks for that advice, Murph.
My pleasure.
Next week on GLT's Grow, we're going to the movies. Oh, but if we're going to go to the movies, you know what we're going to need? Popcorn.
Manja.
So we have advice on how to grow your own popcorn. And if you've got a gardening question for Murph, send that along to us. It's wglt.org/grow.
You can download the Grow podcast weekly at iTunes and at wglt.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find today's edition of Sound Ideas, or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes to find individual stories and interviews from Laura Kennedy, John Norton, Judy Valente, and Colleen Reynolds. Go to WGLT.org to share your comments. Go to WGLT.org or go to Facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News.